you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Greetings, citizens of Earth and all beings, both extraterrestrial and interdimensional. My name is Danny Roth, and this is Who Won the Week, Sci-Fi Wire's podcast dedicated to the top stories from the week in geek. This week, I am joined by contributing editor at Sci-Fi Wire, the Blurred Girl, Kara Mahorn, and Sci-Fi Wire's own editor-in-chief, Adam Swiderski. How was your week, guys?
Delightful.
I was recovering.
I'm still recovering. I'll pull the curtain away and say that I am doing this from home.
You guys made the mistake of getting sick at or after the con, whereas I got sick before the con just to get it out of the way.
No, I was sick. This is the problem: is I was sick before the con, during the con, and I'm still sick.
That's impressive.
I think I'm dying.
Well, yeah, okay. So Adam's an overachiever, and Danny's on his deathbed.
What happened is that I was sick, and then I began to sap Danny's life force in order to heal myself. And
yeah, because the moment you got on the plane, I lost my voice. I think you were sapping everyone's life force at Emerald City Comic Con.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, that makes sense. You're just like the naked alien vampire lady from Life Force.
Just like that in so many ways.
And luckily, this is a podcast.
Yeah, see? Don't have to make it X-rated at all. Nobody has to see it. Nobody wants to see it. All right, so we've got a lot of stuff that we're going to talk about. We're going to do a little bit of a wrap on Emerald City because so much happened there. We'll talk about the Oscars. We'll talk about Jessica Jones. We'll talk about A Wrinkle in Time. But first, let's talk about what was happening in our own little personal lives, in our own little bubble, safe space that we were nerding out about. Caramel, what was going on with you this week?
I was geeking out over a few things. One was, over the weekend, I got to interview Chris Claremont, one of my comic book heroes from X-Men, which was really, really interesting. And that actually interview was up on Sci-Fi Wire. And then this week, I got to go to the Society of Illustrators and interview Mike Mignola, who is another person who I'm a fan of. He's, those of you who know Hellboy and BPRD and the amazing Screw-On Head, these are some of his works, and he's a really great interview, and he's a really nice guy, and it's really funny. He's, as most artists are, I think, not a fan of his own work, so it was really tough for him to curate this hall of pieces, but it's all original art. If you guys get a chance to, you got to definitely check out, go down to the Society of Illustrators, and which is an amazing space anyway, and check out his work. I got to geek out over some comic book people.
Did he talk about the movie at all?
He didn't talk about the new movie. He talked about the old one. And one of the things that he mentioned, he said he loves, loves, loves Guillermo del Toro. Also, this video is going to be, if it's not up today, it'll be up over the weekend, probably on Sci-Fi Wire. But he felt it was a little soft, a little light, a little soft-handed. He said, you know, Hellboy's a dark story. BPRD is a dark story. And he felt they were a little light-handed with it. And so as much as he loves Guillermo and everybody who worked on the project, he's looking forward to the 2019 version, I guess, because he thinks it's going to be a little bit darker, which is what he originally intended. He also cannot stand watching animated stuff, like the Amazing Screw-On Head animation and Gotham by Gaslight, because he looks at it like art, and he's like, that's not what I drew. He can't look at it. He can look at live action, which I thought was really interesting. Because he's not making any parallels there. But yeah, it was really, really interesting. And he's a really nice guy. Like, he's a guy that you'd be like, come on over for coffee and donuts. Like, and just, you know, talk about the business.
Donuts.
I know, we're all hungry in here. How about you?
Well, let's see. I have had a change of heart.
Uh-oh.
This is like It's a Wonderful Life and A Christmas Carol and all those other change of heart movies, like, all wrapped up into one. On the way to Seattle, on the plane mm-hmm. for Emerald City Comic Con. One of the on-demand movies that they had on demand was Thor Ragnarok, which, as anyone listening to this podcast will remember, I did not enjoy as much as most.
He did not. He was very vocal about that.
I was. And I watched it on the plane on a lark. And I, on a second viewing, I actually really kind of dug it. And you want to hear a really funny story. This might impugn my editorial integrity here. But so when I saw Thor Ragnarok in the theater the first time, I may have nodded off once.
So maybe how long was it,
so Adam?
Let's get into that part. So I in the theater, I nodded off and I woke up. I'm like, oh God, okay. I dozed off for a second. Watching the movie on the plane, I realized that I fell asleep for probably a good 20 minutes and missed a good 20 minutes of the film. And not only that, but it is 20 of the funniest minutes of the movie, which is basically everything from the climax of the gladiator fight between Thor and Hulk until Valkyrie brings them to Loki. All that interaction in Hulk's apartment, everything.
You missed all that. Him getting out of the
yes,
pool
and,
butt naked.
And boy, did I feel like an idiot. Because I was like, oh, this movie isn't as funny as it was so funny. And then like 90% of the funniest stuff in the film is in that
through.
Segment. Yeah, so
I am no longer going to trust anything you say now, but any review.
I know.
Like, I hated it. Were you asleep?
It's a little bit of a mea culpa here to say that I may have judged that film too harshly based on the fact that I did not see all of it. And now that I've seen all of it, I really enjoyed it. But it wasn't just that. It was some of the visuals that I kind of, I guess I appreciated them the first time, but like really got to, you know, pay attention to details, like with God, that beautiful shot of Valkyrie leading the charge against Hela. Yes.
The
oh my God, that
off.
Whole segment is amazing.
Yeah.
And so I am geeking out over my new appreciation for Thor Ragnarok. I still don't I don't know where I would rank it on my Marvel film.
But you still think Tessa Thompson's amazing.
Well, duh.
Okay, I'm just checking. Cause like
yeah, I mean, come on.
We would fight if that would be
No.
Okay, I'm just checking.
But yeah, so I've achieved a new appreciation for Thor Ragnarok. That is what I'm geeking out about this week.
And naps, apparently.
Good. Yeah, I can't wait for you to also rewatch Kong Skull Island and turn around on it.
Looking forward
to that one.
Unfortunately for everyone involved, including myself, I was awake all the way through Kong Skull Island.
You guys are never going to agree on this one.
I know.
No, this is like the real, this is the one. This is the actual conflict between the two of us.
If
never
Danny
had one before and never will again, but
true.
Definitely Kong Skull Island.
If Danny and I ever actually fight to the death,
it would be over Kong Skull
about.
Island.
Yeah.
Whatever else happens
Boy,
between
what a sad way to go.
If that happens, can I have your headphones, Danny? I'm just...
Yeah, of course, you can. Aha!
See, I like where Karama's head is at because you know the assumption there being that I win,
or you both die. Yeah. But I just like his headphones better.
Hey, Danny.
Wow. Yes, sir.
What are you into this week? What are you geeking out about?
I had, other than being sick for like the last week and a half, I believe that I had arguably the greatest week of my life.
But it killed you.
So, unfortunately for one of our editors, Tara Bennett, who had been setting this up for a long time, she's out on the West Coast. There was sort of a threat of a big storm. So she wasn't able to make it out here to New York. But she had set up an interview with a couple of people. Here are some names. Fran Brill, Dave Goles, Bill Beretta, and Frank Oz, who are the Muppets. They are four of the original people who were responsible for being the puppeteers and voices for a lot of the original Muppets. And yeah, they asked me very last minute, would you like to go in and sort of pinch hit for Tara and do the interview? And I had to think very hard about that because, gosh, do I want to meet the Muppets? I was really nervous. So what I did was I focused entirely. It was our producer, John Irwin, and I, and also Tara, who had sent over an email of all the notes that she had written. So to preface, there's a documentary coming out called Muppet Guys Talking, which is just about an hour or so of them having these conversations about a lot of things that you didn't know that were happening behind the scenes. All good stuff, all about, you know, Jim Henson's process and sort of some information about the creation of the Muppets and some of like the risks and the challenges that they sort of encountered as they went and did some of these shows and movies. But I was very nervous. I think John was also very nervous. But we were so, I think, enveloped in creating what the shape of the interview was that we didn't really think about it too much, about how shaky we were, until it was all over. So they came in and we did the interview, and it was, even in the process of it, I could feel myself getting a little emotional. But, you know, you got to be a professional. So we, you know, John and I both kept it together. John kept facing toward the monitor and not really looking at us. And they were lovely. I cannot express how lovely they were. And when it was all over, John and I cried like children, because it was just so big and overwhelming to talk to people who were such a huge part of our childhood. I don't want to ruin what's in the interview, and I don't want to ruin too much of what's in the documentary. The documentary will be out this coming Friday, so a week from the time that we're recording, and I believe that the video that we did is going to drop either the day before that or on the same day. And there is some information that they gave to us that is not in the documentary, so think of it as kind of like a little bit of a companion piece. And I know they've did some stuff with Good Morning America, and I think they're probably going to make waves and kind of go around and talk to a couple different outlets. But they gave us some really cool stuff, and yeah, Frank Oz hugged me at the end.
Wow.
And yeah, and he tweeted about me. If you want to look at Frank Oz's Twitter timeline, you will see him mention me by name, and it was very strange. Because yeah, I mean, all of those people are, I don't really know that I have.
But not strange bad. It was strange good.
Yeah, no, it was amazing. I just, you know, it's the kind of thing that I feel like I've spent days still since we did it processing the fact that it happened. You know, like I came home and told my wife about it, and I cried again, and then, you know, and then I called my parents and were like, guess what? And then I cried some more. So, you know, it was very emotional, because, yeah, I mean, the Muppets and Sesame Street and Fraggle Rock and Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas.
Fraggle Rock.
And things. Yeah, I mean, there's like a million things that have been a huge, huge element of my life. And the thing that I said to them at the end is that I feel like what they did was they ferried me and millions of other people from childhood into adulthood without us losing our sense of wonder. And that is enormous. You know, I don't know that anybody else could have done that. So, you know, it was amazing. It was really phenomenal. I hope people will watch the documentary. I hope they'll watch the interview that John and I put together with Tara. I'm really proud of it. I'm really, really lucky to have had a chance to do it. So there you go. It was maybe the best week of my life. So there you are.
Well, all right.
Okay.
I saw a movie on a plane. That was so there.
You yeah. Got me. You got me.
Anyway.
All right. So do you want to talk about Emerald City? Because that was another. I mean, last week was also sort of amazing too, in
sure.
A number of ways. Just to sort of wrap it up, and if you hadn't had a chance to see us talk about things any of the other places, this is kind of an opportunity to re-say some important things, and maybe if you had any other new thoughts, Adam, what are your sort of final thoughts about Emerald City and what you got a chance to do?
I thought it was really cool. We've all kind of talked about this as we were doing it, but Emerald City as a con felt kind of intimate relative to some of the other cons I've been. Most of my other con time has been in San Diego and New York, which are both really huge.
Yeah, I agree.
So this felt a little more intimate, very comics focused still, which is good in an era when a lot of cons are going and branching out. Not just branching out, but leaning hard into non-comics media.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a very cool experience. Everybody that I got to interact with on stage was super nice. Most of them were really good interviews and had a lot to say about their work, which was great. I guess a particular highlight for me was, I had two, which is one was talking to Jonathan Colton, who, as a musician myself, I've kind of looked up to for a while. He's a pretty smart and interesting guy. And then talking to David Hayter was also very, was an interesting experience. That's a guy who's, it's just interesting with the hats that he's worn. He's obviously the voice of Solid Snake in the Metal Gear series, and he's known for that pretty well. But he also wrote X-Men and X-Men 2, which are the movies that, you know, Blade aside, kind of set the stage for the superhero movie boom. Without those two movies, we wouldn't have that, I don't think, you know. So getting to talk to him about what it was like to work on that versus where things are now was a really interesting discussion. So yeah, and listen, like, I want to shout out to everybody involved in this on the production side. Everybody on our team, I thought, Danny and Karima included, did outstanding work.
Thank you.
Yes, of course. And so if anyone hasn't seen it yet, we have some video excerpts from that up on YouTube. Please check it out. And
you can also go to sci-fi.com/Emerald City.
Or that.
You can see the links.
Yeah.
But and yeah, then, it was fun.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like a field trip. But yeah, besides me totally losing my voice, which was fun, I got to stay there till the end because Typhoid Adam over here left early.
I did.
But I think I had some great interviews on stage two. I mentioned a couple of them. It was great talking to Editor-in-Chief of Valiant also, because I'm actually a Valiant comics fan. We talk a lot about Marvel and DC here, but Valiant's got a lot of stuff coming out, and it was really fun to talk to him. It was really funny, too, because I guess he doesn't normally talk to people who know his comics, and I was, like, grilling him, like, dude, tell me why this happened with Quantum and Woody, and, you know, how many children exactly does Bloodshot have? And he was like, whoa, okay, which is fun. Tim Sale, who is an artist that I've also followed for a while. Interesting piece of trivia. Found out that Tim Sale is colorblind. Is the same person who put out Spider-Man Blue and Daredevil Yellow. So his colorist, he relies on very heavily. And he's got the colorblindness that just doesn't let him see tones. Like, if it's blue, it's blue. He can't see, like, teal, aqua, all those things. It was really interesting in the interview. But a lot of the interesting stuff I saw also happened not on stage. I was able to run around the con a little bit on Saturday and Sunday and got to the game room. Like, I was so mad. Had I known, I would have been there first day. They had, like, old school arcade, like, when I was little, like, Pac-Man and Centipede. And
do they have Tempest?
Somebody said there was, but I didn't see it.
That's my jam.
I believe it.
Yeah.
But there were, like, three or four rooms, and I could really only get to one. Huge Cards Against Humanity tournament thing going on, a lot of tabletop, and there was this, I didn't real the basically the space was laid out like a mall, so it's like every floor and every hallway had something, which was really fun. And then I think the most fun thing that happened to me was I got to meet the cast of American Gods when Cher Martinetti was interviewing them for the fangirl segment, and Ricky Whittle hugged me.
Oh,
I also got to have dinner with Itide Badaki, which is great too. So it's like I had, that was my little bit of stardom. But Ricky's just yummy, isn't he, Danny?
No comment.
Sure. You yes, know
yes,
he
yes,
is.
Yes, he is.
I'll say he is. I have no problem saying that.
And a sweetheart too. Like, he was really personable, and they're all very excited about the fans that are there. So yeah, that was. How about you? Danny, what did you think of Emerald City? What was your impression?
I liked it. You know, I have
to
say...
That's all you get. Yeah,
that's it. The end. It was good. It was good. Fairly well. And now...
No, but wait. Yeah. ElfQuest. Come on.
Set me out to sea. And then, you know, it's like the Viking burial at sea where you, like, shoot the arrows with the fire. I'm done. No, I did see. I met Richard and Winnie Penny, who are the creators for the now completed ElfQuest saga, which took, you know, only 4 decades. I made a point of reading the last issue right before I met them. I said, "Well, this will be smart," and it was pretty emotional. ElfQuest is the first comic that my wife ever got into, and so we have a number of ElfQuest things here, and I brought this old tabletop role-playing book that has all of this stuff in there, all of these interesting ideas that didn't make it into the comics until later, which is kind of cool, kind of shows their process a little bit and how long-term they were in their thinking. But they were really lovely to talk to. I'm trying to think what else happened at the con. You know, it's funny because all of the really interesting stuff for me was the back end. It was the stuff that people didn't see. It was, you know, what wasn't the front facing.
Yeah.
Because it was for me, it was like a test of everybody's mettle because, you know, we had never done this before. We'd never done a live stage that was constantly streaming. And so that was the most exciting thing for me, was knowing that, you know, we were going to do this. We were going to see how it goes. And that, you know, for the most part, it went, I mean, like the front facing stuff was all great, you know, and then of course there's a scramble of stuff behind the scenes. But I think what matters is that we pulled it off. And I just feel incredibly lucky. We had such a good group of people that kind of all came together. And anytime an issue arose, you know, there was always somebody there to sort of, you know, pick things up and keep the baton going. So that was great. And I also really liked meeting Damian and Adrian Wassel, who are the two guys that run Vault Comics. And I think Vault Comics is one of the upstart companies that's really changing the game. I would say like them and Black Mask, I think, are two of the companies that are making comics right now that really excite me. So I'm really excited to see what they're going to do in 2018. We got a little bit of a taste, a little bit of a preview. There's some other stuff that I know they're going to be putting out that they haven't announced yet. I know there's a book coming from my friend Vida Ayala, who you finally met in person at this convention.
I did, which was wonderful.
So I think possibly we'll be the ones debuting that information sometime in the next week or months. But I'm really excited to see what they do next. And I have a lot of friends that are pitching out to that company right now. So that was exciting. But yeah, I mean, it was just kind of cool to see that we could do it. You know what I mean? I was just so excited to say, hey, Sci-Fi can do this thing. Wire is capable of this level of professionalism. And that made me feel really amazing and so proud to be working with the two of you and obviously everybody else behind the scenes.
And hey, we're going to do it again in 3 weeks.
We are.
At C2E2 in Chicago.
And speaking of Chicago, the one thing I forgot to mention is I finally caught up with Spike Trotman, who runs Iron Circus Comics, which is one of the largest indie comic book companies in Chicago. And she's kind of kickstarted everything she's made, but she has got a huge following, made over like $1 million last year through Kickstarter alone, putting out her own anthologies and things like that. And that interview I was able to put up on the Indie Comic Spotlight column this week, if you want to learn more about that. But I was really excited not just to meet her, but to interview her and then also to feature her for International Women's Day. So yeah, that was one of the other highlights, just talking to a creator that's out there grinding and getting it done.
Yeah, I got a chance to meet her too, and I bought a comic from her. Because that's what you do.
That's what you do.
That is met what no you one. Do.
Oh, you did. You met people.
True. I met some people.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you know what?
I forgot them almost instantly.
I wanted to say, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's it. It was a bad joke. Go ahead.
You're a bad person. No.
Did you guys enjoy Seattle, the city, though?
Like, I love Seattle. Seattle is like one of my favorite cities in the country.
Danny, did you get to walk around at all?
A little bit, but yeah, I mean, what I saw, I really liked. You know what I really hear? Here's what I'll say. My number one favorite thing about Seattle was thus. The food was very expensive, and here's why it costs so much. Because they pay their servers a living wage. So thanks, Seattle. That's like a huge thing for me. I wish that things cost, like, I don't usually say things should cost more in New York City because everything is so expensive here, but honestly, like, I'd rather pay a couple extra bucks for some flapjacks or whatever at a diner so that I know that the people that work there are going to be able to afford the places that they live. Would be nice. And I think that's one of the best things about Seattle. In addition to it being like a green city, the fact that they, you know, pay servers a living wage. Kind of cool.
I agree.
All right.
There you go. Not to be too political about it, but it was nice. It was really nice. Anyway, hey, how about them Oscars?
The Oscars happened.
They did.
Yes, they did.
And that was finally, that was a thing.
Finally.
Yeah, big,
Jordan Peele finally won an Oscar, and it was not a musical.
A big day for genre movies, I would say, for science fiction, horror, etc.
Yeah, I mean, there's two, I think, that are like immediately jump. One of them being Jordan Peele winning for best screenplay and for Guillermo winning for best director and best film or best picture.
Yeah, I mean,
kinda
I think
cool.
I think that was one of the best reaction I saw to this was that I saw someone say on Twitter, you know, it's sad that Get Out didn't win Best Picture. I probably would have voted for that myself. But we have to keep in mind the Best Picture was given to a movie in which a mute woman has sex with the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Wow.
And what a wonderful time it is to live in when something like that can happen.
Well, also,
yeah, I feel so seen.
I mean, Roger Deakins finally,
yes,
finally,
that was cool.
Finally winning an Oscar.
I was glad to see Blade Runner get a couple of nods. It also won for Best VFX.
Yes.
Which I thought was pretty well deserved.
And Coco. I'm glad Coco got a little
got a little love. So yeah, a lot of sci-fi, fantasy, horror films showing up this year. Hopefully it continues. I mean, it's big for Guillermo del Toro. Like, everybody's speculating now, can he write his own check? Will he be able to get his At the Mountains of Madness movie made because he's an Oscar winner, Guillermo del Toro? Stuff like that. So that'll be really interesting to see what he does next.
I mean, there's a lot of possibilities that can come out of that. But what I really like about it is Shape of Water, even though, yes, there's a bit of this Creature of the Black Lagoon thing to it. It's, you know, original. Get Out. Totally original. So not only was it genre stuff coming to play, but also it was these sort of newer, fresher stories. So I hope that one of the lessons that we're going to learn in 2018 is that stale, old, relying entirely upon nostalgia without quality is no longer going to cut it. And original ideas that challenge viewers and trust viewers to take a leap are going to succeed, both in award shows and also as far as, you know, money goes, because, I mean, that's what anybody really cares about.
And shout out to Frances McDormand, who had the best speech and made everybody learn what an inclusion writer was within the next 24 hours.
Yeah, that was good.
The funny thing was, when you Googled that immediately that night, there was nothing about it.
Right.
Like, I couldn't find anything.
Yep. Except 24 hours later.
Yeah, 24 hours later, there's 15 articles explaining what an inclusion writer is.
Yep.
Do you have any other strong comments about the Oscars before we move along?
No, well, I mean, the other big thing, it's going to be interesting to see if this does crack. My one Oscar gripe will always be Andy Serkis got robbed for his portrayal of Caesar in War for the Planet of the Apes, which in my opinion was the best male acting performance of last year. I don't care what CGI he was covered in. That was some epic work. So
I'm sure Andy Serkis agrees with you.
Yeah. So Andy, if you're out there listening to this podcast, which I know you do every week, you're my man. I think you got robbed. And the other interesting thing Oscar-wise to come out this week is that there's a little bit of a hint that Disney's going to push Black Panther Oscar-wise next season. That would be really interesting because this is a franchise superhero film, which is a type of thing that does not normally get Oscar attention.
No, I mean, like,
Lord, would that be awesome?
We wanted Logan to win something, and it didn't, and that was frustrating.
But even that, I would say, isn't necessarily a franchise. It's such a splinter version of that, whereas Black Panther is squarely in the MCU, you know? So it would be really interesting to see that get some Oscar props next year, which I hope it does.
I think Ruth Carter should win something for costumes.
We'll see. Yeah, I mean, certainly I think that stuff in particular, I think the costumes really are something that leapt out to me in particular in that movie. There's a reason why if you looked around New York that there were places that showed the costumes specifically and some of the knitwear. So, yeah, I mean, I think that would be especially great. I would be satisfied with that. I mean, if it gets more, that's fantastic. But right now, I think the costumes are a really, really, really big thing for me. And also, it's nice that it's going to break over $1 billion this weekend. So
I want
Danai
Gurira to get a Best Supporting Actress nomination.
Yes, I completely agree.
If that doesn't happen, I'm burning it all down.
and I will like that match.
Yeah.
Hey, you want to talk about Jessica Jones? We haven't. None of us have watched the whole thing, but I got to say, I actually think that's ultimately probably for the best. I don't want to ruin the entire run.
Yeah, we will
of
not ruin this
of Jessica
I've seen,
Jones.
We'll ruin
I've
it next week.
Four, yeah, we'll destroy it next week.
Yeah, next week we'll just wreck it. But this week we're going to kind of give a flavor.
I've seen 4 episodes. How many have you seen, Danny?
I've seen 5.
Okay, and you've just
I've
seen the
seen
first one.
Right?
And you slept. And you slept through half
person.
Of it, right?
No, I did not. I slept through none of it. No. This is not a normal thing for me. I just want to point that out to everyone. This is not something.
But you've
that
got a busy job. We wouldn't. It wouldn't surprise us. You've got a lot going on.
It's true, but no, most of the time I'm on so much cocaine that I can't even close my eyes. So anyway.
So first of all, I mean, let's start with the one thing that we all did watch, and that's the majority of the first episode.
Yeah.
Jumping back into it, it's Jessica, you know, at her best, at her alcoholic best.
At her, I'm doing the air quotes when I say at her best.
Well, I mean, you not, did well, mention this is, here's the she's thing. Fighting better.
Here's the thing. I my enjoyment of this show will be hampered, always be hampered by the fact that I do not enjoy the work of Kristen Ritter.
Oh, interesting.
In the role, particularly. I enjoyed her in The Bee. I really enjoyed The Bee. But
I don't trust that bee.
No matter what apartment she's in, okay? But no, in this particular role, I am not a fan of her work. I find it kind of one note. And yeah, so it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard for me to be like, I love Jessica Jones, because I don't love the person playing Jessica Jones. So anyway, that's my two cents. I'm done.
Cool. Jessica Jones is the only Netflix Marvel show I like.
Well,
it is the only one that I will watch to completion, like completely pulling the curtain back. Whenever we talk about these things, I only ever watch 5 episodes or whatever it is and then stop.
No, I like Daredevil.
I don't get into any
that.
Of them. Like, I'm not into Daredevil. I'm not into Iron Fist. I'm not into Defenders. No thanks. Like, they just don't really do it for me. The first season of Jessica Jones, I plowed through and thought about it for a really long time afterwards. And I suspect that this one, I have really mixed feelings about season 2 so far. I mean, I appreciate what it is. I know people have been kind of mixed on it, call it a sophomore slump. But what I like about the slower pacing is that it's very specifically dealing with the impotent rage that women have, even though they have all this power, but feel like they're judged if they use it in any way whatsoever. It's always, you know, a call out like, oh, should women be doing this? Should they be using this power that they have? Kind of feels super relevant right now. And so I think that her frustration is something that I think is very relatable. And I really understand her. And I think that it sort of speaks to the rage that a lot of people are dealing with. That's great. Something that I found to be less great in the 5 episodes that I have seen so far is a total lack of black women in lead roles. Like, here's who I saw that I remember. There was a prostitute.
I knew you were going there. Yep.
And the other thing that really got me, and it was in the last episode I watched, and it made me angry. And it's the only thing that has made me angry about the show so far, because I've seen this before, and it is a trope that I wish would die in a fire. They made a point. The other black woman I remember is she was a cop.
Yes.
And she was referring to superpowered people, and she said, quote, you people. And then Jessica Jones was like, you people. And I was like, listen, this thing where it's black people being racist against superpowered people that I see all the time needs to end. It needs to end yesterday. It needs to end last week. It needs to end 5 years ago. I don't know why we're doing it. It's garbage. It's terrible. And every time it happens, it makes me furious.
Well, it's a very simple way of saying, hey, look, we're having a diverse conversation because we're having somebody of color use what is normally a term or a concept that by someone who's a white male against another either woman or person of color. It's done repeatedly. It's not new. I did notice the lack of, well, let me just be more specific. I didn't just notice the lack of women of color. I noticed the lack of Misty. I thought Misty Knight was going to make an appearance early on. Like, when she gets arrested, I'm like, oh, we're going to go see Misty. But we didn't. And I don't know if she's going to show up later. Because I'm only 4 episodes in, I'm not going to tear it up, like I said, until next week when we see everything. I think the interesting thing besides the lack of women of color is, although I meant to say this, the New York looks more New York to me, and there's more diversity in the extras and the scenes that I'm seeing. Like when she's having lunch with her mom and stuff, I'm like, yeah, okay. I would see all these people in New York. Like, that made more sense. I think the thing that was interesting to me is that I think last season, because Purple Man and what she went through with him was there was this thread of like sexual trauma that she'd been through. I feel like they decided to throw that type of concept again into this early, like episode, tail end of episode 3, basically episode 4. And for those of you listening, it's not a rape scene or anything like that, but there is trauma that is referenced to, and there's somebody who basically confesses that, you know, something happened. They were assaulted when they were younger. And I felt like, although I do want to feel for the characters, I don't want to keep feeling for them because they've been sexually assaulted. So that sort of, I don't want to call it a trope, but I want everybody's arcs to develop. And again, this was only one character. I'm not going to say who it is. I want to see, like I said, I'm kind of on the fence like you, Danny. I'm definitely going to sit up and like do a facial and drink half a bottle of wine and watch the rest of this this weekend. But because that's what I do with Netflix. But I don't think it's a sophomore slump. I think it's a sophomore meh. Now, to your comment about Ritter, though, Kristen, yeah. Ritter, it's funny because we're in the comics. I didn't think Bendis gave her. I felt the character wasn't completely three-dimensional when Bendis wrote her.
Right.
So it's really funny because I actually think Kristen's doing a very good job of doing the
translating
character. Exactly.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
I don't know that that's a good thing in terms of acting.
And how do you, I mean, admittedly, I'm only one episode in, but like, and I hate to say this because it's you know, a show called Jessica Jones and it's important. It's a female-led show and everything, but David Tennant last season was such a critical part.
Yeah.
And that their relationship and their dynamic was such a critical part of what made that show compelling. And I don't know how you match that.
That baddie has not shown up yet. I feel very Luke Cage with this. Like, we're going to see one baddie and then we're going to see another. Because there were also very serious hints in the trailer that Purple Man's coming back.
What?
I mean, we don't know what that means. I'm very interested to see. I think they're waiting a little too long, and I think this is the part of the idea that this is a bit of a too slow burn. The thing that I think we're lacking is so there is a character in this, and this is within the first 5 episodes, and I feel like it's been talked about enough that we can sort of reveal this, is that there is a character played by Laurie Metcalf who has basically the same power set as Jessica Jones and is some kind of antagonistic figure that is attached to the season-long mystery. And I find that the idea of Jessica Jones investigating and relating with this character to be very interesting, but they're playing up the mystery so hard that we haven't had nearly any, in the first 5 episodes, interactions between these two characters. And I think, you know, I mean, Laurie Metcalf is an amazing actor, I think is really, I mean, especially, like, you know, if you live in New York, she's a great Broadway actor, but she's also a great TV and film actor. And so I'm very excited to see that. I think that is the thing that I wish that we maybe got to a little bit earlier. I presume in the second half of the season, there will be more of the two of them. They also
Always does that, though. Marvel Netflix always has a slow burn up front. And then the meat and potatoes is like 4 or 5 episodes in the middle. And then they always end with one more episode than they should. They should always end all of them at the same. Yeah, I mean, or one extra character in case of Luke Cage than they should. I did see, I feel like Laurie Metcalf came in on episode 4. Am I wrong, Danny?
I don't remember the first time she actually appears. I think it might be a little bit earlier than that.
They have
an encounter in a bar.
Yes.
That's the first thing I remember happening.
Yes.
So I think that's episode 3.
I think it's episode three
where they have the thing in the bar. And that's pretty interesting. Yeah, I mean, like, to me, that's that story. And then also they introduce at the end of episode 5 a character played by another great genre performer, Callum Keith Rennie, who I would say, if you knew from anything, would probably be Battlestar Galactica. He's one of the Cylons in that. And he's a great, I think, sympathetic antagonist, but then also just like antagonist kind of actor. So I'm looking forward to sort of seeing how him and Laurie Metcalf are going to play in. I wish they showed up a little bit earlier. But yeah, I mean, I think that shows a lot of promise. Again, I know that people have been kind of mixed on it, but there's a lot that I do appreciate. In particular, I do think that it's about this sort of feeling of impotent rage. And I think that Jessica Jones trying to figure out who she is and how to be less angry all of the time or use her anger in better ways is an interesting story. I think that they're doing some interesting stuff between Jessica and, you know, and Patsy. I think that, yeah, like this, there's a potential for a Hellcat storyline that we're headed towards, which is kind of cool. And, yeah, and the relationship that maybe they're setting up between Laurie Metcalf's character and Jessica Jones is also interesting. It's a lot of women relating to other women. And I think Carrie Ann Moss has also been pretty interesting, although maybe a little underutilized. She was the reason, the impetus for the prostitute character to show up. And I was like, I don't know. But well, I like Carrie Ann Moss, so we'll see.
But that character was gender swapped in the original. This was originally a man who would sexually assault the people around him and things like that. I think it was an interesting choice to make that character a woman, make her a lesbian, make her still no less like horrible to her employees and the people around her. But it's clear that obviously she's been diagnosed with something. We don't know what it is, but it, you know,
it looks like ALS. There you
go. Okay. They did talk about it. Okay. Thanks for that. Cause I didn't know that.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Part. One other little bit of trivia, with a guy that you meet in episode one, Whizzer is actually an old Marvel character. I'm a fan of random characters, and he would have a yellow outfit with a big W on it and like horns. He looked like Flash basically, or Reverse Flash, and like blue briefs. So when he showed up and he had the yellow raincoat with the blue, I'm like, oh wow. And when he said his name was Rizzer, I just giggled all over the place because it just was like such a cute ode. But then in the same way I always have this fear on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., the moment he said his name and I knew he was a older franchise character, because they do this on S.H.I.E.L.D. all the time, I was like, I knew he was gonna die. Because it's sort of like a red shirt thing. Whenever you see a character like that, whenever they bring, like, oh, look, here's a character that we had in 1957 on S.H.I.E.L.D., they kill him. And it's like,
So we have that to look forward to.
Yes, we do. So he had a spoiler and I had a spoiler. But how he dies is very interesting. And you should definitely watch for that. I get the feeling, now, Danny, you're one more episode in than I am. I get the feeling that we might be getting another Luke Cage two different baddie situation, which I don't like. I loved the first episode, first season of Jessica Jones with Kilgrave being the only antagonist. But is that happening? Is there like Laurie Metcalf's character and then another one? Because I feel like...
They've introduced this Callum Keith Rennie character, but the thing is that they're kind of connected to one thing. Now, I have no idea what the rest of the season is going to hold, but I think it's, you know, they're sort of dealing with this mystery of why does Jessica Jones have powers? Where do these particular kinds of powers come from? And I think it's an interesting story, but... Again, I think that just like season one of this show, the success of it and what people liked about it is the fact that you're coping with something, right? You're dealing with something. So in the first one, it was this kind of assault that Kilgrave is responsible for. And this is kind of similar. I think it's a little more generic. It's like, hey, from your very youth, there's always something that is... explaining why it is that you are what you are, that permeates every aspect of your life, that makes you feel angry and frustrated about the world. And that is, again, it's very relatable. You know, they're sort of taking this supernatural, superpowered way of dealing with it. But yeah, I mean, I like that. I like that conceptually. It's just that I think they're sort of struggling with how to execute that idea. So, I mean, I don't know. We'll see after the first five episodes. We'll talk about it a little more.
I've only watched the first one next week. And my wish for how this would go, and I don't think it will, is that Hellcat is the villain.
Yeah.
But not really. It's basically villain. Like, here's what I would do if I was the writer. Patsy is all taught. I want to help people. I want to change. So she's investigating all about how Jessica gets her superpowers. She finds out somehow she like, gets it's like, I want to get superpowers so that I can help people. And then Jessica is like, wait a minute, you have to think about this. What does it really mean to be doing this? And then they fight, and that would be my plot. But unfortunately,
there are multiple characters that could be heading in that direction. Let's leave it that way.
But I just think Patsy.
There's
would be
more
the most
than one that could be doing something like that. Yes,
or
the
Trish,
consequences
I say
of
Trish.
Powers.
Trish
Walker, with great wait, what is it? There's wizard says a thing.
With great power, there's great mental instability.
Yeah. With great power comes
great mental illness. Yeah. Because
an interesting sort of take on it.
It is because all of these power people have been made and they're jacked up. Like they all have, I mean, when you think about it, Jessica has obviously anger management problems. Wizard, yeah, he was a speedster, but he also was on psychotropic drugs because it made him schizophrenic. You know, all of these, the other guy, the one that was from last season, that was taking inhalant. Yeah, it made him rage out over the top. Like you couldn't reason with him, and his adrenaline was so high he could take a bullet.
Big statement on Big Pharma, I suppose, to a certain degree. Anyway, all right, I don't want to belabor that too much longer because we still have to talk about one more thing, a movie that we have all seen to completion, which is A Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah. That's true.
You guys want to talk about A Wrinkle in Time?
Yeah.
Sure. What did you think about it last night? What did you think, Adam?
It's hard to say. I don't think I enjoyed it very much.
He hated it.
I didn't. No. I don't want to say that either. Like I didn't hate it, and it's there are elements of it I really liked, and I thought were beautiful. I mean, it's visually an amazing film. But it's like it's weird because it's like looking back at the experience. Did I enjoy the experience of having seen the film? Not so much. And I really wanted to. And I'm glad it exists. And I'm glad Ava DuVernay is a director who gets handed a major project like this from Disney, and that they cast it the way they did and everything like that. I'm super happy about all of that. I just wanted to like it a lot more than I did.
Well, for me going into it, two things. One, I read the book when I was 12. So 12-year-old me, I think, would have loved this movie. And that's what I kept thinking. Like, this is a family film. This is a kid's film. Like, I feel like I'm too old to be in here and watching this movie. It's beautiful. But it really felt to me like it was advertised to an older age group, but it really is for kids. I also went in there knowing that Ava has a slower pace. Everything, Selma, her TV shows, all the other stuff she's done, her pace is her editing pace and her speech pace, everything. She likes a slower pace. So I was curious. I'm like, I don't know if going in, I'm like, I don't know if this slower pace is going to work with fantasy, but we'll see. And I think in certain places it did, and in other places it didn't. The other thing visually for me, I understood what she was trying to do, but I don't know if it quite worked. The first act of the film was full of very tight shots. And then when we got out into the other universes, there were these wide sweeping expanses, which were beautiful. But I felt sometimes it felt claustrophobic. It did not feel, which I don't think was the intent. It was supposed to feel intimate. And sometimes I think the cinematography felt claustrophobic in the beginning. When we got into the wide open spaces, it was like, oh, thank God. But it was, again, it was beautifully shot. It was beautifully art directed. The little boy, her little brother, that little boy needs to win an award.
Oh, no, I disagree with you
so
much.
You don't think so? You didn't like him?
I was going to say, one of the things I was going to say is I don't know how tasteful it is to go in on child actors, so I don't want to get too...
I really had problems
with his performance. And I really had problems with the fact that the kid who plays Calvin his running form is the weirdest thing I've ever seen.
Oh yeah, well,
his arms are flailing forward. I don't know anyone who does that, like with their palm, with his palms out, like when they're running.
I felt like he was running
full
in place.
Speed. It was weird. I was like, what? Either like, why did no one direct him to just run? Like, just run like you run as a person, unless that's how he runs as a person, in which case something's going on there. But anyway, so yeah,
I really like Charles Wallace. I'm sorry.
I that kid felt like just a vacuum.
Aww.
And you know, the character It's interesting.
But the character was supposed to be taken over.
No,
so
but
easily.
Even before that, it's just, no, I don't know. Whatever. I mean, again, I don't want to go into Hardy's a kid. I don't want to be like, he sucked. But I did not enjoy that particular aspect of the film.
I'm going to have to disagree with you. I thought the kid was fun. I actually found him more entertaining than Storm. But I will say this, and I think this was personal for me. When she did see her father, when she did finally get to him.
That scene was great.
I burst into tears when I saw that. Because it was really funny because I was like, the two things that went through my mind is, one, I've lost my father. So it was like one of those things, like if I ever saw my father again. So I know there was that kind of emotion. But the second thing that was there, I was just looking at this young actress going, where did that come from? Like, where in the world? What have you been through? And where did you pull from to get that look on your face and that yell? Like, I just couldn't, like, I'm welling up now. It was very, very emotional. And I couldn't figure out, like, good Lord, girl, who hurt you? Like, how did you get there? But, I mean, again, Chris Pine was great, but there just wasn't that much of him.
Yeah. Well, wait, before we get into Deets at Danny, what was your overall impression?
I loved Storm Reid. I actually thought that she was the best thing about the whole movie, honestly. She was the one that really sort of made it worthwhile. I do think, so you know, my criticism of certain movies, and I think that this is a thing that bugged me about it, but I sort of accepted this movie was not quite for me, is that, you know, these outlandish and fantastical things happen and people's reactions are like, oh, wow, this is weird. And I'm like, oh, wow, this is weird. You should be like, what is going on? You know what I mean? Like, why is that not, you know, people don't quite act like people.
Well, I actually think
movie,
Storm did a little bit. She was the only one in the beginning that was like, this is weird. There's people in my house.
Yeah, it was basically like her and Gugu and Bathara. Like, you know what I mean? Like, Reese Witherspoon walks in and Gugu's like, you got to go. So I liked. But, you know, really my only criticism was that. And then everything else about it is just, you know, people have said this before, that A Wrinkle in Time is unadaptable. It is not an easy book to adapt. It is a really, really weird book. And I think that some problems, Adam, your critique of Charles Wallace is less to the actor and more to that character. Charles Wallace is a really weird chosen one kind of dude, and I actually think they mitigate his chosen oneness from the book into this adaptation of film, which I appreciate, but I do think he's a very difficult character to adapt, so I don't know if I would put that on Derek McCabe so much as just, I think he's a very difficult character to play and to write for. So, yeah, I mean, I think there are just things that are a real challenge in adapting this particular story.
I mean,
but I still liked it.
I don't disagree that it's difficult, but that doesn't mean that I don't know. It doesn't mean I like graded it on a curve personally. You know, it's like there's Lord of the Rings is a difficult book to adapt. And yet, you know, somehow they did it. Like there people were talking for years about how you could never make those into films. So while I agree that Wrinkle in Time is a difficult book, and it's not like, it's interesting because there's actually very little that happens in this movie overall, like in terms of action and plot, and that's fine because that's what the book is. Like, I'm not against having a more meditative film or more with a more leisurely pace. It just felt a distinct lack of any sort of momentum. And I think that they could have, I mean, like, for example, with Charles Wallace, we're told he's the greatest mind. He's the greatest mind. We're told all this stuff, but we're never shown, you know, and that's one of the basic rules of filmmaking, show me, don't tell me, right? But we don't get that. We get just people saying, oh, he's brilliant. Okay, like,
We don't get to see a demonstration.
Yeah,
of it.
Or not even demonstrations, but that's, again, that's filmmaking, is you show that. You don't have just people say it, and then everyone is just taking it. It doesn't give the character anything to build on. So for me, I felt some of that, too, where it was, we're told things and we're told various things about characters, but we don't get to see them, that development and those things happen for them. I mean, Meg, I thought we did in a great way. You know, we were told she's troubled, but then we see it. We see it acted out.
We physically see her
do it
on
screen.
We see her being bullied. We see all the things.
You know, even Calvin, we get a brief moment of him, seeing that flash
his
of
dad.
Him home with his father.
Yeah.
And otherwise, you know, there's some.
By the way, I don't think Calvin blanks. Went anywhere in this movie. He's going to go home and his father's going to slap the shit out of him. I'm sorry. He's the only one that didn't get to take a trip.
Yeah. But so anyway, that was, and like, I don't know. I mean, it's, again, it's hard because I really, and I like, I do agree with Karamer. I am stunned this movie was not rated G. I don't think it should have been rated PG. I think there's some violence, but nothing that like a kid couldn't handle.
Yeah, and especially kids now who are playing video games and everything else.
It's like, very much a kid's movie, and I'm fine with that. I like a lot of kids' movies, but I think about a movie like The Neverending Story, right, which was a kid's movie when I was growing up.
But there was death.
There was death, and there was, you know, I don't know, there was momentum and plot and suspense and a sense of investment, I guess, that I never quite got from A Wrinkle in Time.
I also to bring that back to the pacing.
Yeah.
Just Avis got a slower pace. Yeah. There were certain scenes that, like, as an editor, I would just sit there and like, we should be done. We should be out by now. We should be next one. But they were beautifully constructed scenes. And again, anybody who's listening to this that has children that wants to see it, take your kids. They're going to love it. Like, it is a spectacle, I think, for children.
Or take some really good hallucinogenic drugs and go see it.
Take some amazing edibles. Wait, we're not in Seattle anymore.
That's right.
Yeah, you better watch yourself. Oh, I didn't know that David Oyelowo is the voice.
He's
of
it. Yes, yeah. That's the first thing cool, I looked right? up when I left there, because I was like, I want that voice, sounds so familiar. Who is that? But he was the voice of the It.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I want to give some credit to certain actors. I mean, I think everybody, for the most part, did a great job. And I was surprised. I don't always like Zach Galifianakis. I think he's kind of a lot. But I liked him in this.
Yeah,
I liked Reese Witherspoon. I liked Mindy Kaling. Of course, you know, it's hard not to have feelings when Oprah Winfrey is on the screen. But one thing that I will say was kind of a bummer.
She looked like I'm mad she I was about to say Goku. She looked like a game character. But, I mean, one of the things that's funny, I was out with my boyfriend, and he kept saying, like, Oprah's just playing Oprah. Like, kind of. Yeah. She's, like, basically talking you through your stress, your troubles, telling you everything's going to be okay, just in amazing makeup and dresses. Which, by the way, again, costume design, every time the witches walked on screen, I was like, or floated. I was like, whoa, like they did an amazing job with their costumes.
Yeah, it was cool. And there's some cool 3D printing from it, too. There's a headdress that Mindy Kaling wears in particular. And it's mm-hmm. cool because I think two of the last movies I've seen that and Black Panther have utilized 3D printing in costumes in a way that's really exciting. So that's,
yeah, Angela
that's
Bassett's
a cool thing to see.
Crowns were 3D printed in Black Panther.
Yeah, I'll tell you, there is definitely something that got cut from that movie, though. Somebody came in and cut out when they get to the, when they first get to Kamazots.
Yeah,
and they're in that place where like everybody's, you know, like doing things at the exact same time, and it's like this sort of suburban hellscape.
Yes,
there is an actor there. Her name is Bellamy Young. She is in Scandal. She is the president's wife. And she's in the movie, and she's in the movie for about 2 minutes. And I was like, nah, there was more to this fact, because it's in the book, too. Like, that character has more. In fact, that whole setup is in the book a bit of the introduction to Charles Wallace going to a darker place. It's introduced in that place.
And I think, when he says he couldn't take the sound, that goes deeper. Also, there seemed to be more of that scene in one of the trailers. So maybe we'll see that, you know, on the DVD or something.
And I guess, I mean, that's kind of a problem too, or for me a problem too, is like, you know, they bring up that, yeah, I can't take the sound.
They never address it.
It's not linked to what happens to him later. It's just kind of there. And, you know, I'm not a person who wants gift wrapped answers to everything. Like, I love ambiguity in movies, but it's just stuff like that that you just kind of bring up and discard. I don't know. It makes it feel weird. It makes it feel like you can't tell what's important to pay attention to, and what are the things that are actually having an effect on the characters, because it was a kind of shallow brushing over those types of things. Like Danny said, it's like people not reacting. You know, they end up on an alien planet, and they're just kind of like, oh, hey, cool. and, you know, I don't know.
I mean, there's some things that Meg would explain with science, which were great, which was also, again, proving that she had a similar mind to her father and could figure this out. But again, I think you're right. Her character was fleshed out more. We got examples of her smartness, her intelligence, her adaptability, just like her father. You got examples of all that, and as well as her anger and her pain and stuff of losing, you know, when she thought she lost him. And the other character didn't get as much.
And like, you know, as a contrast, you know, then you get when Mrs. What's-It changes into this dragon. Like, that process took a good, like, 20, 30 seconds, and they're all just like, whoa! These shots of them going, oh my gosh! And then, like, that's probably the least amazing thing that's happened to them in the last 10 minutes of the movie. And, you know, that's the thing they reacted to the most. It just felt weird. I don't know. Like, and again, not weird in a, I love weird, but not in an unsatisfying way.
Wrinkle in Time is such a weird book. That's the other thing. Like, and that's why I said 12-year-old me would have loved it, because it was so, it did have the same feel of the book, but again, it was the pacing that was slow, I think. And that's definitely what you're reacting to.
Not even slow, but like glacial. Lacking momentum. Because I think you can be slow
as long
still
as it
move.
Gets to something.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this felt slow with no destination, for lack of a better way of putting it. To me.
I have a question, mm-hmm. and it is going to be a question wherein, Karima, you have to answer it and represent all black women everywhere. So
right,
I'm
because that's what I do
it.
On Fridays, apparently.
Enjoy it. How did you feel about the hair thing? Because they really play up to it a lot. You know what I mean? Like, Calvin keeps talking about how he likes her hair when she sees her idealized self that's presented by the it. You know, her hair looks is completely different. Like, this is a thing they really played into, and
well,
I know why they did it. I just don't know how successful they were at it.
That wasn't the only thing that they played into. This is like, I mean, Ava said it, that this is a love letter to little black girls everywhere. So it's not just the hair, it's the confidence. Going all the way back to the school, being told that you're a bully or you're too angry, when it's very clear that other people are too angry. Black women are told this all the time. When you're too strong, she's a bully. You hit her. Okay, but everybody knows this girl's a bully. That was one part of it. And then also the two comments about, there's three comments about the hair. But the first one was, when he was like, oh, I like your hair. And she's like, oh, please don't do that. And he's like, okay, I really like you. Then they start having a conversation. Now later when he does say it again, she's able to accept the compliment that he's actually giving her and not like, please don't play into the stereotype or whatever. The girl, that the version of her that the it shows her with the straight hair and the short skirt and the cute, she's basically dressed almost like very, very similar to the girl that was bullying her. So throughout the film, it's not just the hair. It's throughout the film, it's about her hair, her personality, her look. She's constantly told, and if she's operating out of fear, she plays into other people's fears of her. Even when she's in the backyard, she's like, come over here. You got to come over here because, you have a good reputation. I'm trying to help you here. You're going to be seen with me. People are going to talk about you. Come over here so she won't see us. So that's another thing. Like, here, let me, I'll help you, but I won't let anybody see us together. That way no one will make fun of you. So those themes were throughout the film, and I can appreciate those, which is why, again, I said my 12-year-old self really, really needed this movie. And again, why I think it's really for kids. And even the concept of being bullied and the fact that it all comes from something. I mean, that's a very Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe kind of thing too. Like the very clear concepts of good versus evil, and how you deal with them and what they represent metaphors that they have on screen. But yeah, I don't think it was just the hair. I think it was throughout the movie. And I honestly could appreciate that. And I thought that was another layer that they gave Meg. That was wonderful. But again, I don't think anybody else got those layers. Like, I kind of wish Gugu had some of those layers.
Yeah, she has no layers at all. It's kind of a bummer. But yeah, no, I like that. I mean, they make a point of it. They say, it's Mrs. Wetzit who says, you know, the gift I give you is the gift of your flaws.
Yeah. And she's like, but they're my flaws. And she's like, are they? You know,
well, and that was one thing. I mean, one of the things I I did like, although they didn't really address it in a direct way, was at the end, and I, you know, we're in major spoiler territory here, so I guess if you haven't seen the film, you might want to tune out. But, you know, Chris Pine's character is shown to be flawed.
Yes.
In a way, you know, when he, rather than try to stay and save Charles Wallace, he wants to escape. And
he's like, well, maybe I can just save one. Like, right, he's right, thinking right. like a scientist.
And, but the fact that then Meg accepts him after that, you know, that he's gone from this perfect, and this is something that I really enjoyed about Black Panther as well, is the idea of a character who's kind of idolizes their parent, realizing that they're a human person with flaws, and that's okay, you know, that doesn't make them bad, it just makes them a human and not this idealized person. And the fact that Meg could accept him after that, I thought was a really poignant moment. That they didn't hit on the nose, and I'm glad that they didn't. She didn't say, well, you tried to leave us, but blah, blah,
you
blah.
You saw it on her face, though.
Yeah.
She had a moment.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the same moment that you saw when she first hugged him, when she first saw right. him. It was like, you know, we're going to talk about this later.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gotta look.
So that was cool. I liked that aspect of it, and I think that was a good theme to tap into for kids especially.
So do we all agree that Storm Reid did, like, of all the things that we may have liked or not liked, do we all agree that Storm Reid did a really good job? With, you know, what she was given?
Yes.
Yeah, I think she did a great job. She was definitely my favorite performance in the film.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that there are some ways.
I just wanted to like one
speaking,
thing about the movie.
No, yeah. I like several things, I mean, like, about the movie.
I think it's narratively not perfect, but emotionally and I think subtextually it's there. So I do think it's worth seeing, and especially I think for... the role that they gave to Storm, and I think Meg Murray, yeah, I mean, like, is a love song to, I think, a lot of young kids, but especially young Black girls. So that's, I think, really worthwhile. And yeah, I mean, I felt something watching it, even though I thought that it was an imperfect film, even though there were things about it that I didn't like. So,
and I want to say, like, I don't, there is no perfect film. Like, I don't, except maybe Raiders of the Lost Ark, but I don't like, so I don't know. It's hard because, like, then it is good that they cast it the way they did and that they wrote the character the way they did for Meg, and all of these things, you know, like, are important and good, and, you know, the representation aspect and the fact that Ava DuVernay is helming it, I think, is all awesome, and I want to support that. It's just hard because I didn't like the movie. You know, it's like those two things.
But they don't have to be mutually exclusive.
Well, yeah,
you can like how it was set up and how she created it, but still not like the end product. You can
right,
do that.
Right. I feel like they're separate in my mind. It's like, okay, it's good that we have a you know, young mixed race girl playing the part and turning in a really good performance and all of this stuff. I just
but see,
overall, I just didn't like the film.
But here's the thing. If there were more movies.
I just
movies,
think it's not for you, and I think that's okay.
But here's the thing, if there were more movies like this and there were more people helming them and more people of color, I don't think I'd feel so bad.
Yeah,
like,
no,
if there was more to choose from.
Yeah.
Like, you can say Raiders of the Lost Ark was great, but well, now you like Thor again.
That's right.
But but Kong Skull Island was not.
Right.
You know, and
I can definitely say that.
But there's other options. There's other options there. Like, so the thing is, what I hope this movie does do, and Black Panther, and I've said this, is that open these discussions and get these, as Frances McDormand say, inclusion writers going, so that we do see more movies and there's more to choose from. So it's like, oh, I didn't like that one, but I did like that one. And they all happen to be directed by women or women of color or, you know, LGBTQ represented, you know, characters and things like that. So it's like, let's just get more so that there's more to choose from. That would be my thought. But no, they're not music. That's not mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
I completely agree.
All right. Well, I'm glad we cracked that code.
Yeah.
Nailed it. Did it. Okay. I'm wrapping it up. We're wrapping it up. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please, if you are not subscribed to Who Won the Week, subscribe to it. Give us a review. Please make sure you're checking out the other podcasts at Sci-Fi, Strong Female Characters, and The Fandom Files, or if Jordan Zacharin were here, The Fandom Files. I just like the way, the way he says it. That's how he says it. I mean, I'm just putting it out there. Please check out all the coverage from Emerald City Comic Con. Go to sci-fi.com. What's the /? On that one, Karima?
/ Emerald City.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And before we sign out, where can people find everybody online?
They can find me, Karma, the Blurred Girl, at THEBLERDGURL everywhere, all over social. But as usual, I get mail on Twitter.
And this is Adam Swiderski. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at RockTheFaces.
And my name is Danny Roth, and you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Danny Ordinary. That is Danny with one N, Ordinary, also with one N. This has been Who Won the Week. Thank you for winning our week, and we'll see you again next week.